After his childhood years of repression on Gedi Prime, young Duncan Idaho found the lush world of Caladan a paradise. He'd been landed without a map in a city on the opposite side of the world from Castle Caladan. Janice's friend, the second mate Reno, had discharged his obligations to the boy, then kicked the stowaway out onto the streets of a lowland spaceport. Paying no further attention to him, the crew offloaded their cargo of recyclables and industrial scraps and took on a fresh load of pundi rice wrapped in bags made from grain fibers. Without saying goodbye, without offering advice or even wishing Duncan well, the second mate had climbed back aboard his cargo hauler and returned to the Highliner in orbit. Duncan couldn't complain. At least he had escaped from the Harkonnens. Now all he had to do was find Duke Atreides. The boy stood there among strangers on a strange world, watching the ship ascend into the cloudy sky. Caladan was a planet of rich and compelling smells, the air moist and laden with the salt of the sea, the sourness of fish, and the spice of wildflowers. In all his life on Gedi Prime, he had never encountered anything like it. On the southern continent, the hills were steep and covered with intensely green grasses and terraced gardens hacked into the slopes like drunken stair steps. Teams of hard-working farmers moved about under the misty yellow sun. Not wealthy, but still happy. Wearing old clothes, they transported fresh fruits and vegetables on suspensor-borne pallets to the marketplace. As Duncan stared with hungry eyes at the passing farmers, one kindly old man gave him a small, overripe Paradan melon, which the boy ate voraciously. Sweet moisture dripped between his fingers. It was the most delicious meal he'd ever had. Seeing the boy's energy as well as his desperation, the farmer asked him if he would like to return and work in the rice paddies for a few days. The old fellow offered no pay, only a place to sleep and some food. Duncan readily agreed. On the long way back, the boy told him the story of his battles with the Harkonnens, how his parents had been arrested and killed, how he had been chosen for Rabban's hunt, and how he had eventually escaped. "Now I must present myself to Duke Atreides," he said with complete faith. "But I don't know where he is or how to find him." The old farmer listened attentively, then gave a grave nod. Caladanians knew the legends of their duke, had witnessed the greatest of his bullfights at the departure of his son Leto to Ix. The people here honored their leader, and to them it seemed fundamentally reasonable that any citizen could request an audience with the Atreides. "I can tell you the city where the duke lives," the old man said. "My sister's husband even has a map of the whole world, and I can show you. But I don't know how you could get there. It's very far away." "I'm young and strong. I can make it." The farmer nodded and led his visitor back to the rice paddies. Duncan stayed 4 days with the man's family, working up to his waist in flooded fields. He waded through the water, clearing channels, inserting small but hardy seedlings into the loose mud. He learned the songs and chants of the pundi rice planters. One afternoon, spotters in the low-hanging trees banged on pans, sounding an alarm. Moments later, ripples in the peaty water signaled the approach of a school of pantherfish, bog dwellers that swam in packs searching for prey. They could strip the flesh off a farmer's bones in moments. Duncan scrambled up one of the tangled tree trunks to join the other panicked rice farmers. He hung in the low branches, pushing Spanish moss aside as he looked down and watched the ripples approach. Beneath the water, he could see large, many-fanged creatures armored with broad scales. Several of the pantherfish circled around the trunk of the swamp tree in which Duncan had taken refuge. Some of the creatures rose up on scaled elbows, rudimentary arms with front fins that had developed into clumsy claws. With most of their bodies out of the water, the carnivorous fish stretched upward, large and deadly. They blinked wet, slitted eyes at the young man who hung just out of reach in the branches above. After a long moment of staring them down, Duncan climbed one branch higher. The pantherfish submerged again, swirling away out of sight in the sprawling rice paddies. The following day, Duncan took a spare meal the farmer's family had packed for him and trudged off toward the coast, where he eventually found work as a net rigger on a fishing boat that plied the waters of the warm southern seas. At least the boat would take him to port on the continent where Castle Caladan lay. For weeks he worked the nets, gutted the fish, and ate his fill in the galley. The cook used a lot of spices that were unfamiliar to Duncan. Hot Caladanian peppers and mustards that made his eyes water and his nose run. The men laughed at his discomfiture and told him he would never be a man until he could eat food like that. To their surprise, young Duncan took this as a challenge, and soon he began asking for extra seasoning. Before long, he could endure meals hotter than any other crew member. The fishermen stopped teasing him and began to praise him instead. Before the end of the voyage, a cabin boy in the next bunk did a calculation for Duncan that showed him that he was 9 now, by almost 6 weeks. "I feel a lot older than that," Duncan responded. He hadn't expected to take so long to reach his destination, but his life was better now, despite the incredibly hard work he'd taken on. He felt safe, freer in a way than he had ever felt before. The men on the crew were his new family. Under cloudy skies, the fishing boat finally reached port, and Duncan left the sea behind. He didn't ask for pay, didn't take his leave of the captain. He simply departed. The ocean-going sojourn was just a step along the way. Never once during his long journey did he ever deviate from his main goal of reaching the old Duke. He took advantage of no one and worked hard for the hospitality he received. In a dockside alley, a sailor from another ship once tried to molest him, but Duncan fought back with iron-hard muscles and whip-fast reflexes. The bruised and battered predator retreated, finding this wild boy too much for him. Duncan began hitching rides on ground trucks and cars, and sneaked aboard tube trains and short-haul cargo thopters. Inexorably, he moved north on the continent, toward Castle Caladan, getting closer and closer as the months passed. During the frequent rains, he found trees under which he could huddle. But even wet and hungry, he didn't feel so bad, for he recalled the terrible night at Forest Guard Station, how cold he had been, how he had used a knife to cut open his own shoulder. After that, he could certainly handle these brief discomforts. Sometimes he struck up conversations with other travelers and heard stories of their popular duke, bits of Atreides' history. Back on Gedi Prime, no one had spoken of such matters. People held their opinions to themselves and gave up no information except under duress. Here, however, the locals were happy to talk about their situation. Duncan realized with a shock one afternoon as he traveled with 3 entertainers that the people on Caladan actually loved their leader. In sharp contrast, Duncan had heard only terrible stories of the Harkonnens. He knew the fear of the populace and the brutal consequences of any real or imagined defiance. On this planet, though, the people respected rather than feared their ruler. The old Duke, Duncan was told, walked with only a small honor guard through villages and markets, visiting the people without wearing any armor, without shields or fear of attack. Baron Harkonnen or Glasu Rabban would never dare such a thing. "I may like this duke," Duncan thought one night, curled up under a blanket one of the entertainers had loaned him. Finally, after months of travel, he stood in the village at the foot of the promontory that held Castle Caladan. The magnificent structure stood like a sentinel gazing out across the calm seas. Somewhere inside it lived Duke Paulus Atreides, by now a legendary figure to the boy. Duncan shivered from the chill of morning and took a deep breath. The fog lifted above the seacoast, turning the rising sun into a deep orange ball. He marched away from the village and started up the long, steep road to the castle. This was where he must go. As he walked, he did what he could to make himself presentable, brushing the dust from his clothes and tucking his wrinkled pullover shirt into his trousers. But he felt confident about himself, regardless of his appearance, and this duke would accept him or throw him out. Either way, Duncan Idaho would survive. When he reached the gates that led into the great courtyard, the Atreides guards tried to bar his way, thinking him a panhandler. "I'm not a beggar," Duncan announced with his head held high. "I have come across the galaxy to see the Duke, and I must tell him my story." The guards just laughed. "We can find you some scraps from the kitchen, but no more." "That would be very kind of you, sirs," Duncan agreed, his stomach grumbling with hunger. "But that isn't why I'm here. Please send a message into the castle that..." He tried to remember the phrasing one of the traveling singers had taught him. "That Master Duncan Idaho requests an audience with Duke Paulus Atreides." The guards laughed again, but the boy saw grudging respect seep into their expressions. One went away and came back with some breakfast, tiny roasted eggs for Duncan. After thanking the guard, he wolfed down the eggs, licked his fingers, and sat on the ground to wait. Hours passed. The guards kept looking at him and shaking their heads. One asked him if he carried any weapons or any money, both of which Duncan denied. As a steady stream of petitioners came and went, the guards chatted with each other. Duncan heard talk about a revolt that had occurred on Ix, and the Duke's concerns over House Vernius, especially because of the Emperor's acceptance of a bounty on Dominic and Shando Vernius. Apparently, the Duke's son Leto had just returned from war-torn Ix to Caladan with two royal refugees. Everything in the castle was in quite a turmoil. Nevertheless, Duncan waited. The sun passed overhead and slipped below the horizon of the great sea. The young man spent the night curled up in a corner of the courtyard, and with the next morning and a change of guards, he repeated his story and his request for an audience. This time he mentioned that he had escaped from a Harkonnen world and wished to offer his services to House Atreides. The Harkonnen name seemed to catch their attention. Once again the guards checked him for weapons, but more thoroughly. By early afternoon, after being frisked and probed, first by an electronic scanner to root out hidden lethal devices, then by a poison snooper, Duncan was finally ushered inside the castle. An ancient stone structure, whose interior corridors and rooms were draped with rich tapestries, the place bore a patina of history and worn elegance. Wooden floors creaked underfoot. At a wide stone archway, two Atreides guards passed him through even more elaborate scanning devices, which again found nothing suspicious. He was just a boy with nothing to hide. But they wore their paranoia as if it were a strange and uncomfortable garment, as if new procedures had just been instituted. Satisfied, they waved Duncan into a large room with vaulted ceilings supported by heavy, dark beams. At the center of the room, the old Duke sat back and surveyed his visitor. A strong, bear-like man with a full beard and bright green eyes, Paulus relaxed in a comfortable wooden chair, not an ostentatious throne. It was a place where he could be at ease for hours as he conducted the business of state. Atop the chair back, just above the old patriarch's head, a hawk crest had been carved into the dark Alacan wood. Beside him sat his olive-skinned son Leto, thin and tired-looking, as if he hadn't fully recovered from his ordeal. Duncan met Leto's gray eyes and sensed that both of them had much to tell, much to share. "We have here a very persistent boy, Leto," the old Duke said, glancing at his son. "From the looks of him, he wants something different from all the other petitioners we've heard today." Leto raised his eyebrows. He was only 5 or 6 years older than Duncan, a large gulf at their ages, but it seemed they had both been thrust headlong into adulthood. "He doesn't look greedy." Paulus's expression softened as he leaned forward in his great chair. "How long have you been waiting out there, boy?" "Oh, that doesn't matter, my lord Duke," Duncan answered, hoping he used the right words. "I'm here now." Nervously, he scratched a mole on his chin. The old Duke flashed a quick scowl at the guard who had escorted him in. "Have you fed this young man?"
"They gave me plenty, sir. Thank you. And I also had a good night's sleep in your comfortable courtyard."
"In the courtyard?" Another scowl at the guard. "So why are you here, young man? Did you come from one of the fishing villages?"
"No, my lord. I am from Gedi Prime."
The guards tensed hands around their weapons. The old Duke and his son flashed a glance at each other, disbelief at first. "Then you'd better tell us what's happened to you," Paulus said. Their expressions changed to grim disgust as Duncan told his story, omitting no detail. The Duke's eyes widened. He saw the guileless expression on this young man's face and looked at his son, thinking that this was no made-up tale. Leto nodded. No boy of 9 years could have concocted such a story, however much he might have been coached.
"And so I came here, sir," Duncan said, "to see you."
"You landed in which city on Caladan?" the Duke asked again. "Describe it for us." Duncan couldn't remember its name, but recounted what he had seen, and the old Duke agreed that he must have indeed made his way from across the world.
"I was told to come to you, my lord, and ask if you might have something for me to do. I hate the Harkonnen, sir, and I'd willingly pledge my loyalty forever to House Atreides if only I can stay here."
"I think I believe him, father," Leto said quietly, studying the boy's deep-set blue-green eyes. "Or is this a lesson you're trying to teach me?" Paulus sat back, hands folded on his lap, and his chest wrenched with spasms. After a moment, Duncan realized that the big man was holding in great rumbles of laughter. When the old Duke could no longer restrain himself, he burst out with a deep chuckle and slapped his knees. "Boy, I admire what you've done. Any young man with balls as big as yours is a man I must have as part of my household."
"Thank you, sir," Duncan said. "I'm sure we can find some urgent work for him to do, father," Leto said with a tired smile.
He found this brave and persistent boy to be a hopeful change from everything he had seen recently. The old Duke rose from the comfort of his chair and bellowed for retainers, insisting that they supply the boy with clothes and a bath and more food. On second thought, he held up a hand, "Bring an entire banquet table. My son and I wish to share lunch with young Master Idaho." They entered an adjacent dining room, where workers scurried and clattered about, setting up everything their Duke had commanded. One servant brushed flat the boy's dark and curly hair, and ran a static cleaner over his dusty clothes. At the head of the table, with Duncan seated on his right, and gray-eyed Leto on the left, Paulus Atreides sank his chin into a large fist. "I've got an idea, boy. Since you proved you could handle those monstrous Harkonnens, do you think a mere Seleucid bull is beyond your capabilities?"
"No, sir," Duncan said.
He had heard about the Duke's grand spectacles. "If you want me to fight them for you, I'd be happy to do it." "Fight them?" Paulus laughed. "That isn't exactly what I have in mind." The Duke sat back with a huge grin, looking over at Leto.
Leto said. I think we've discovered a position for you here at Castle Caladan, young man. You can work in the stables, under the guidance of stable master Iresk. You'll help tend my father's bulls, feed them, and if you can get close enough, groom them too. I've done it myself. I'll introduce you to the stable master. He looked over at his father. Remember, Iresk used to let me pet the bulls when I was Duncan's age. Oh, this boy will do a lot more than pet the beasts, the old duke said. Paulus cocked a gray eyebrow as platters and platters of magnificent food were brought to the table. He noted the enchanted look on Duncan's face. And if you do a good enough job in the stables, he added, maybe we can find some more glamorous tasks for you. History has seldom been good to those who must be punished. Bene Gesserit punishments cannot be forgotten. Bene Gesserit dictum. A new Bene Gesserit delegation, bearing Gaius Helen Mohiam, arrived on Gedi Prime. Freshly delivered of her sickly Harkonnen daughter, Mohiam found herself in the Baron's keep for the second time in the space of a year. She arrived in daylight this time, though the greasy cloud cover and pillars of smoke from unfiltered factories gave the sky a bruised appearance that strangled any hint of sunshine. The Reverend Mother's shuttle touched down at the same spaceport as before, with the same demand for special services. But this time Baron Harkonnen had secretly vowed to do things differently. Stepping in perfect rhythm, a stony-faced regiment of the Baron's household troops marched up to surround the Bene Gesserit shuttle, more than sufficient to intimidate the witches. The Berseg Kriubi, formerly a pilot on Arrakis and now head of Harkonnen House Security, stood in front of the shuttle debarkation ramp, 2 steps ahead of his nearest troops. All were dressed in formal blue. Mohiam appeared at the top of the ramp, engulfed in her Bene Gesserit robes and flanked by acolyte retainers, personal guards, and other sisters. She frowned with disdain at the Berseg and his men. What is the meaning of this reception? Where is the Baron? Berseg Kriubi looked up at her. Do not attempt your manipulative voice on me, or there will be a dangerous reaction from the troops. My orders state that you alone are allowed to see the Baron. No guards, no retainers, no companions. He awaits you in the formal hall of the keep. He nodded toward the attendants behind her in the shuttle. None of these others may enter. Unthinkable, Mohiam said. I request formal diplomatic courtesy. All of my party must be received with the respect they are due. Kriubi did not flinch. I know what the witch wants, the Baron had said, and if she thinks she can show up here to rut with me on a regular basis, she's sadly mistaken. Whatever that meant. The Berseg stared her down eye to eye. Your request is denied. He was far more frightened of the Baron's punishments than of anything this woman could do to him. You are free to leave if this does not meet with your approval. With a snort, Mohiam started down the ramp, flashing a glance at those who remained in the ship. For all his perversions, the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen is somewhat prudish, she said mockingly, more for the benefit of the Harkonnen troops than for her own people, especially when it comes to matters of sexuality. Kriubi, who had not been apprised of the situation, was intrigued by this reference, but he decided that certain things were best left unknown. Tell me, Berseg, the witch said to him in an irritating tone, how would you even know if I was using voice on you? A soldier never reveals his full arsenal of defenses. I see. Her tone was soothing, sensual. Kriubi didn't feel threatened by it, but wondered if his bluff had worked. Unknown to this foolish soldier, Mohiyam was a truth-sayer, capable of recognizing nuances of falsehood and deception. She allowed the pompous Berseg to lead her across an overpass on a walkway tunnel. Once inside Harkonnen Keep, the Reverend Mother put on her best air of aloof confidence, gliding along with feigned nonchalance. But every one of her heightened senses was attuned to the slightest anomaly. The Baron made her extremely suspicious. She knew he was up to something. Pacing restlessly in the great hall, Baron Harkonnen looked around, his black eyes flashing and intent. The room was large and cold, the harsh light too bright from unfiltered glow globes clustered in the corners and along the ceiling. As he walked in pointed black boots, his footsteps echoed, making the entire hall sound hollow, empty. A good place for an ambush. Though the residential portion of the keep might appear vacant, the Baron had stationed guards and electronic spy eyes in various alcoves. He knew he couldn't fool the Bene Gesserit whore for long, but it didn't matter. Even if she learned they were being watched, it might give her pause and prevent her from pulling her insidious tricks. The caution might at least gain him a few seconds. Since he planned to be in control this time, the Baron wanted his people to watch. He'd give them a very good show, something they'd talk about in their barracks and troop ships for years to come. Best of all, it would put the witches in their place. Blackmail me, indeed. Peter de Vries came up behind him, moving so swiftly and silently that he startled the Baron, who snapped, "Don't do that, Peter." "I've brought what you asked, my Baron." The twisted Mentat extended his hand, offering two small plugs, white noise transmitters. "Insert these deeply into your ear canals. They're designed to distort any voice she might try to use. You can still hear normal conversation, but the plugs will scramble the unwanted, preventing it from reaching your ears." The Baron heaved a deep breath and flexed his muscles. The preparations had to be perfect. "You just take care of your part, Peter. I know what I'm doing." He went to a small alcove, snatched up the decanter of Kirana brandy, and took a long, deep swig directly from the bottle. Feeling the brandy burn in his chest, he wiped his mouth and the top of the bottle. The Baron had already imbibed more alcohol than was usual for him, perhaps more than was wise considering the ordeal he was about to face. De Vries, who recognized the Baron's anxiety, looked at his master as if laughing at him. With a scowl, the Baron took another deep swallow, just to spite the Mentat. De Vries scuttled about, relishing their joint plan, eager to participate. "Perhaps, Baron, the witch is returning here because she enjoyed her first encounter with you so much," he cackled. "Do you think she's been lusting after you ever since?" The Baron scowled at him again, this time sharply enough that the Mentat wondered if he had pushed too far. But De Vries always managed to talk his way out of reprisals. "Is that the best prime projection my Mentat can offer? Think, damn you! Why would the Bene Gesserit want another child from me? Are they just trying to twist the knife deeper, to make me hate them even more than I already do?" He snorted, wondering if that could be possible. Maybe they needed two daughters for some reason. Or maybe something was wrong with the first one. The Baron's generous lips curved upward in a slight smile. This child would certainly be the last. No evidence remained for the Bene Gesserit to use as blackmail. Lankeville now hid the largest treasure of Harkonnen Melange right under Abelard's nose. The fool had no inkling of how he was being used to cover the Baron's secret activities. But though soft-hearted and soft-headed, Abelard was still a Harkonnen. Even if he discovered the deception, he wouldn't dare expose it for fear of destroying his own family holdings. Abelard revered the memory of their father too much for that. The Baron walked away from the Kirana brandy, and the sweet burning taste turned sour in the back of his mouth. He wore a loose maroon and black pajama top, tightly sashed across his flat stomach. The pale blue griffin crest of House Harkonnen emblazoned the left breast. He'd left his arms bare to show off his biceps. His reddish hair was cut short, tousled for a rakish look. He looked hard at DeVries. The Mentat gulped from a small bottle of deep red Sappho juice. "Are we ready, my Baron? She's waiting outside."
"Yes, Peter."
He lounged back in a chair. His silky pants were loose, and the prying eyes of the Reverend Mother would be able to detect no bulge of a weapon. No expected weapon. He smiled. "Go and send her in." When Mohiam passed into the main hall of the keep, Berseg Kriubi and his troops closed the doors behind her, remaining outside. The locks sealed with a click. Immediately on her guard, she noted that the Baron had orchestrated every detail of this encounter. The two of them seemed to be alone in the long room, which was austere and cold, awash in glaring light. The entire keep conveyed the impression of square corners and unsoftened harshness the Harkonnens loved so well. This place was more an industrial conference room than a sumptuous palace hall. "Greetings again, Baron Harkonnen," Mohiam said with a smile that overlaid politeness on top of her scorn. "I see you've been anticipating our meeting. Perhaps you're even eager." She looked away, glancing at her fingertips. "It's possible I shall allow you a bit more pleasure this time."
"Maybe so," the Baron said affably.
She didn't like the answer. "What is his game?" Mohiam looked around, sensing the air currents, peering into shadows, trying to hear the heartbeat of some other person lying in wait. Someone was there. But where? Did they plan to murder her? Would they dare? She monitored her pulse, prevented it from accelerating. The Baron definitely had more in mind than simple cooperation. She had never expected an easy victory over him, especially not this second time. The heads of some minor houses could be crushed or manipulated. The Bene Gesserit certainly knew how to do it. But this wouldn't be the fate of House Harkonnen. She looked at the Baron's Stygian eyes, straining with her truth-sayer abilities, but unable to see what he was thinking, unable to unravel his plans. Mohiam felt a twinge of fear deep inside, barely recognized. Just how much would the Harkonnens dare? This Baron couldn't afford to refuse the Sisterhood's demand, knowing what information the Bene Gesserit held against him. Or would he risk the possibility of heavy imperial penalties? Of equal import, would he risk a Bene Gesserit punishment? That too was no small matter. At another time, she might have enjoyed playing games with him, mental and physical sparring with a strong opponent. He was slippery and could bend and twist far more easily than he could break. But right now the Baron fell beneath her contempt, serving as a stud whose genes were required by the Sisterhood. She didn't know why or what importance this daughter might hold, but if Mohiam returned to Wallach Nine with her mission unfulfilled, she would receive a severe reprimand from her superiors. She decided not to waste any additional time. Summoning the full voice talents the Bene Gesserit had taught her, word and tone manipulations that no untrained human could resist, she said curtly, "Cooperate with me." It was a command she expected him to obey. The Baron just smiled. He didn't move, but his eyes flicked to one side. Mohiam was so startled at the ineffectiveness of voice
that she realized too late the Baron had set a different trap for her. The Mentat Peter de Vries had already launched himself out of a hidden alcove. She turned, battle-ready, but the Mentat moved as swiftly as any Bene Gesserit could. The Baron took it all in, and enjoyed what he was seeing. De Vries held a crude but effective weapon in his hands. The old-fashioned neural scrambler would serve as a brutal, high-powered stunning device. He fired a volley before she could move. The crackling wave slammed into her, short-circuiting her mind-muscle control. Mohiam fell backward, twitching and wrenching with painful spasms, every square centimeter of her skin alive with imaginary biting ants. Such a delightful effect, the Baron thought as he watched. She dropped to the polished stone floor, arms and legs akimbo, as if she had been squashed by a giant foot. Her head struck the hard tiles, and her ears rang from the blow. Unblinking, her eyes stared up at the vaulted ceiling. Even with extreme prana-bindu muscular control, she couldn't move. Finally, the mocking face of the Baron loomed over her, pushing itself into her limited field of view. Her arms and legs jittered with random nerve impulses. She felt warm wetness and realized that her bladder had let go. A thin line of spittle trickled from the corner of her lip down her cheek, weaving a path to the base of her ear. "Now then, witch," the Baron said. "That stunner will do no permanent damage. In fact, you'll have bodily control again in about 20 minutes. Time enough for us to get to know one another." He walked around her, smiling, passing in and out of her peripheral vision. Raising his voice so that electronic pickups would transmit everything to the hidden observers, he continued, "I know what false blackmail material you have fabricated against House Harkonnen, and my lawyers are prepared to deal with it in any court of the Imperium. You have threatened to use it if I don't grant you another child. But that is a toothless threat from toothless witches." He paused, then smiled as if an idea had just occurred to him. "Still, I don't mind giving you the additional daughter you desire. Really, I don't. But know this, witch, and take my message back to your sisterhood. You cannot twist Baron Vladimir Harkonnen to your purpose without suffering the consequences." Using all of her training to focus on the output of certain nerves and muscles, Mohiam reconnected her eyes so that she could at least move them to look around. The neural scrambler had been incredibly effective, though, and the rest of her body lay helpless. Fighting his revulsion, the Baron reached down and tore at her skirts. What a disgusting form she had, without the male muscle patterns he so admired and desired. "My, it looks like you've had a little accident here," he said, frowning at the urine-wet fabric. Peter de Vries stood over her from behind, looking down at her broad, slack face. She saw the red-stained lips and the half-mad glint in the Mentat's eyes. Below, the Baron knocked her legs apart and then fumbled at his loose-fitting black pants. She couldn't see what he was doing, didn't want to. Giddy with the success of his plan, the Baron had no difficulty maintaining an erection this time. Flushed in the afterglow of the brandy he had drunk, he stared down at the unattractive woman, imagined her as a withered old crone that he had just sentenced to the most brutal of the Harkonnen slave pits. This woman, who fancied herself so great and powerful, now lay completely helpless, at his mercy. The Baron took enormous pleasure in raping her, the first time he could ever recall enjoying himself with a woman, though she was just a limp piece of meat. During the violence of the attack, Mohiam lay supine on the cold floor, furious and impotent. She could feel every movement, every touch, every painful thrust, but she still had no control over her voluntary muscles. Her eyes remained open, although she thought she might have been able to blink if she worked hard enough at it. Instead of wasting that energy, the Reverend Mother concentrated internally, feeling her biochemistry, changing it. The Mentat stunner weapon hadn't done a complete job on her. Muscles were one thing, but internal body chemistry was quite another. The Baron Vladimir Harkonnen would regret this. Previously, she had manipulated her ovulation to achieve the peak of fertility in this exact hour. Even raped, she would have no trouble conceiving a new daughter with the Baron's sperm. That was the most important consideration. Technically, she required nothing more from the vile man. But the Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam intended to give him something back, a slow-acting revenge he would never forget for the rest of his life. No one was ever allowed to forget a Bene Gesserit punishment. Though she remained paralyzed, Mohiam was an accomplished Reverend Mother. Her body itself contained unorthodox weapons that remained at her disposal even now, even as helpless as she appeared to be. With the sensitivities and remarkable functions of their bodies, Bene Gesserit sisters could create antidotes for poisons introduced into their systems. They were able to neutralize the most hideous strains of diseases to which they had been exposed, and either destroy the virulent pathogens or render them latent in their bodies, keeping the diseases themselves as resources for later use. Mohiam carried several such latencies within her, and she could activate those diseases by controlling her own biochemistry. Now the Baron lay on top of her, grunting like an animal, his jaw clenched, his lips curled back in a sneer. Beadlets of stinking sweat covered his reddened face. She stared up. Their eyes met, and he thrust harder, grinning. That was when Mohiam selected the particular disease, an oh-so-gradual vengeance, a neurological disorder that would destroy his beautiful body. The Baron's physique obviously brought him much pleasure, was a source of great pride. She could have infected him with any number of fatal, suppurating plagues, but this affliction would be a deeper blow to him, much slower in its course. She would make the Baron face his own appearance every day as he grew fatter and weaker. His muscles would degenerate. His metabolism would go haywire. In a few years, he wouldn't even be able to walk by himself. It was such a simple thing for her to do, but its effects would last for years, for the rest of his life. Mohiam envisioned the Baron pain-racked, so obese he couldn't even stand erect unassisted, screaming out in agony. Finished, smug in the belief that he had shown the witch who was the more powerful, Baron Vladimir Harkonnen withdrew and stood up, frowning at her in disgust now. "Peter, get me a towel so I can wipe the whore's slime off of me." The Mentat scuttled out of the room, chuckling. The hall doors were opened again. Uniformed house guards marched in to watch as Mohiam regained the use of her muscles, bit by bit. Baron Harkonnen admonished the Reverend Mother with a cruel smile. "Tell the Bene Gesserit never to annoy me again with their genetic schemes." She raised herself to one arm, then gradually gathered her torn clothes and climbed to her feet with nearly full coordination. Mohiam raised her chin proudly, but could not hide her humiliation. And the Baron could not hide his pleasure at watching her. "You think you have won," she thought. "We shall see about that."